I thought we would start this morning by, rather than jumping in, can you hear? Anyone close the door? Oh, thank you. I thought we would start this morning, and I hope it's clear by now that I welcome any questions at any point. We'll be a bit more interactive sort of from the second half of today going forward. But if there are any questions just to start with what we've done so far, so where we've been, to sort of where we find ourselves. So before we get started, are there questions? Things that continue to bother you? So one question I ask my students during like the syllabus day, you know, you get in, that's always kind of boring. You're just going over and whatever. And so the way the introductions in the classroom normally goes, you know, tell us your name, tell us something about where you're from in a like seminary, like which religious background are you from? Are you pursuing ordination, whatever, those sorts of things. But I generally tend to like asking the question, and tell us your name, your degree plan, and the main theological question that keeps you up at night. Like, what is it that really bothers you? And I like doing this especially in class on ethics, because the question that keeps everybody up at night, in one way or another, there are also versions of this and other questions that keep you up at night, but the question that keeps everybody up at night is the problem of evil. Like, this is the thing that bothers you, you know, if you're thinking theologically, like, in its basic form, like, well, if there's a good God who is all-powerful, why is there evil in the world, right? And so all of the sorts of questions that we address in ethics usually, like, have some reference back to that pretty basic question, like, you know, why is there evil? If there wasn't evil, we wouldn't have to make moral choices, right? And, you know, there'd be no ethics. We would just go right along living and never even notice. So I like asking that question to my students to get the class started. But you don't have to answer that question. I'm just asking, I want to pause to say, do you have questions, things that are bothering you, things that are sort of sticking with you that have been unaddressed to this point? Are you all just bored? Ready to call it quits?
I have not been here the past few weeks.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Welcome.
What you've discussed so far.
Okay.
Unintended consequences.
Ah, yes.
Actions. How do I know that if I'm trying to act virtuously, how do I know that I'm actually going to end up with a virtuous result?
Man, that is a lovely, lovely question. Yeah, so let me do it in the microphone so everybody can hear. So the question is about unintended consequences. So if I'm trying to act virtuously, how do I know that my act will actually accomplish the end that I intend for it without any sort of like unintended consequences following from it? Right? Roughly that? Man, that is a really good question. There's an Anglican moral theologian named Oliver O'Donovan, and he... In a recent volume, wrote a really, really fantastic piece on this, I think. And this is from memory, so I'm not going to get it exactly right. But the way that he puts it is something like, at the moment of action, love's knowledge, so the knowledge that we're trying to, the kind of knowledge that we need in order to pursue a good act, right? So the knowledge that would frame us as agents of love. The way that he puts it is love's knowledge is narrowed to the ground that is just before one's feet. In other words, we can't see everything. We can't see the whole context. We aren't God. We aren't omniscient. We don't have all of the knowledge. And at the moment that we act, our knowledge is narrowed to the ground just beneath our feet. We just take the next step. That's all we're able to do. And for O'Donovan, he continues that for Christians, then, one way of thinking about this is that at whatever point the act is then released. So you know how authors will write in the introduction of their book, like, well, now I have finished writing, right, and I have to release this into the world, and it's no longer my text, but it belongs to the world, right, to the reader. I'm done writing, and once I'm done writing, it now belongs to the reader and to the whatever. So my action, like an author's book, is now released into the world to go and do whatever it is that it's going to do. And for us to have to recover some sense of having realized that our act has accomplished what we set it out to accomplish, O'Donovan refers to this as a mercy vouchsafed by God. In other words, God returns our action to us. We don't get to control it. And so to act is an inherently dangerous thing to do. Because once we've done it, our action just goes out and does whatever it is, right? We don't get to control unintended consequences. That's what makes them unintended. And so to act in the world is an act always of faith in God, to do with our action what it is that we want, that what God wants to do with it. So we surrender our action to God rather than trying to control it. That at least is one, I think, possible way of thinking about it. But we haven't talked about that, so good question. Anybody else?
I think the same thing goes for speaking as opposed to actual action. I'm not the most diplomatic person in the world. And I have maybe a quirky sense of humor. And there have been many times when I've said something that has been taken totally opposite to the way I've intended it, and perhaps hurt the feelings of the recipient of my words. And because I am who I am, I try to be aware of that now that I've spent this many years on Earth. But again, because I am who I am, I don't always succeed. And
I'm the wrong person to ask about that. Last year, when I was teaching my students, they said, "Do you want us to call you Dr. Jingles?" And I think the implied inference, like, you know, the implication was, "You're way younger than us." And I said, "Look, I don't care what you call me. I can fail you. Right? I want you to do the work." And some of them didn't like that. You know, it's true. I could have failed him. But the point was that it was a joke. I was thinking about this preparation for this morning session. And I tried to indicate last week, like, when I told you the story about giving the lecture, and I was like, it was a really, really serious topic, and I thought I was on the verge of laughter at a really inappropriate time, but I looked like I was gravely serious, right? I mean, I really like I like the fun of it. I like the, it's enjoyable to me. I tell my students I'm in it for the jokes, right? Like I really like that. And I think that one indication that you might be doing ethical reflection poorly is that you've lost your sense of humor. Right? It's that you've lost your sense of humor. Like you take your morality so seriously that you can't laugh. At the same time, you don't want to be glib and ignore the real grave issues that you're dealing with. But, you know, if you take your own purity so seriously that you can't laugh at, like, the insanity of the world, you probably aren't, like, taking into account all the factors that go into making moral decisions. Like, idiots, you know? There are just a lot of them in the world. And you have to make your decisions in relationship with them and to them.
Did you read Pearls Before Swine? It's like an epic lesson.
Yeah. Okay, so shall we get started? Any other questions before we jump in? Okay, so last week I concluded roughly with sort of describing how there's a transition in sort of the history of thought between people who are set apart for life with God, right, in the monastery, desert, blah, 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 and sort of to those of you listening, microphone just dropped. So those who are set apart for, like, life with God, and then what Charles Taylor calls, with Martin Luther sort of leaving the monastery, the affirmation of ordinary life. But the The difficulty is that ordinary life is constituted by multiple overlapping spheres, you might call them. And navigating multiple overlapping institutions or spheres is difficult. You have to choose between showing up to work on time and dropping your kid off at daycare and doing this, and right, you have to make choices between the claims that different institutions make on your life all of the time, rather than just having your time regulated by like the clock at the monastery or something. There, so ordinary life is something that we can celebrate, but also something that we all experience as a very complicated thing. This is part of the thing that makes it funny, right? It's this is why you have like situational comedies, and because it's just ordinary life, the ordinary course of life is a real pain in the, like, you know, it's difficult and complicated. And so trying to navigate and figure out how it is that we make choices between the institutions that bear on our lives is one of the things that we have to address in a world where we take ordinary life to be something of value, where we actually do pursue the goods that are worth pursuing. Being a good parent, being a good employee, being a good boss, being whatever, right? So I've suggested in the first 2 weeks that the way that we can, that there are a set of ways that we can reflect on making these choices. We can look at the rules, we can look at the goals, and we can try and look at the virtues that would be necessary to make good choices in the world. I think the last thing I said last week was that the virtue sort of model focuses on character formation. What kind of person should I be rather than what kind of world should I try and make? Right? What kind of thing should I try and do? What kind of person should I be? The other two, rules and goals, focus more on what my colleague at SMU calls states of affairs. So you look at the world and you see a set of affairs that you take to be either morally complex or morally heinous, and you make choices to address them. Make sense? So a moral question is just, you know, a question that has to do with what is good or right to pursue and where we see something going radically wrong in the world. Now, one question that I ask my students often, it's the only trick question that I ever ask. And I always set them up before I ask it so that they should have the resources they need in order to answer it and recognize it as a trick question. But I've only ever had one recognize it as such. The way that I set them up is I tell them about St. Augustine. And St. Augustine thought that evil, he described evil as a privation. So the good, God, is also the perfect existence. God is not a thing. God is, if you like, thingness itself. Because for a thing to exist is better than not to exist. And so God is perfect existence. So anything evil is what takes away from, reduces evil. And the reason that you want to think this way, if you're Augustine, is because you had actually spent your early part of your life as a Manichaean, where you thought that evil was a property. It was an existence in the world, and this was related to bodies and stuff. So when I teach my students this, I tell them that Manichaeanism, if you need a shorthand way to understand what Manichaeans believed, it's salvation via defecation. Did you catch that? Are you familiar with both of those terms? Okay. All right. The idea is that for Manichaeans, the good and evil are trapped, and they're polar opposites. Sorry, not trapped. They're polar opposites. And the light, the pure good, is trapped in the world, in material being, and it wants to escape and reascend to, like, heaven. Let's call it heaven. It's not the right term, but let's call it that. And light, pure good, is trapped in the world in this thing. And the only way that it can escape is for the holy people who have achieved this enlightenment to eat the things in which light is trapped, and for their bodies to do the things that are necessary for those things to break down to release the light back to go up to heaven. And so it really, salvation does depend on holy people taking a dump. That's That's Manichaean belief. And this was what Augustine had believed in his early life. You're all looking at me like I'm crazy. So for Augustine, evil is a privation of goodness, not a thing in itself. Evil has no existence. It is the lack of existence. So if you need a contemporary model of this, think Voldemort from Harry Potter. Voldemort has broken himself up, and he's fragmented, and he's just a shell of himself. We still have residue of this language all through our language, right? Like a shell of yourself. This person is dried up, vapid, empty, right? And so you're not what you were intended to be. You're not a full version of yourself or of anything. And so I tell my students all of this. And so for Augustine, evil is a privation. It's the lack of being, the lack of goodness, right? And so I ask them, if you could eradicate one evil from the world, what would it be? And eradicate means to uproot, to pull out, right? If you could eradicate one evil from the world, what would it be? Now, there are lots of good answers that they try and give, right? Poverty, child sex trafficking, you know, whatever it is. Like, the grotesque de jure is the answer. And I've only had one student say, well, if evil is a privation, there's nothing there to eradicate, right? I was like, oh, that's right. So ethics, rather than thinking about it as being the uprooting of evil, which is to give evil a kind of existence, is about the pursuit of good, the upbuilding of being, helping people become what it is that they are supposed to be. This is really complex when you start thinking about the kinds of ethical problems that we are addressed with, because we have to talk in terms of child trafficking, right? It's a thing. We can address it. We can try and address states of affairs, but we have to make choices between these goods in the ways that we address it. We have to make choices between how it is that we address it, so that we're not saying that child trafficking is an evil that is somehow the opposite of God. It makes God have opposites, and this is a theological mistake. All right, so how do we think about this? How can we make choices within this really complex set of issues? You know, we don't want to say that evil is a thing and thus end up at a salvation via defecation sort of world. But we also don't want to just let evil metastasize, right? How do we address this? How do we make choices in this really complex state of affairs? What do you think? I need to take a break for drinking coffee. So what do you think? Are you totally confused? Any questions? I mean, this is a lot. Yes?
So if it's between something that we know without question is evil, like child sex, I don't think we have a problem figuring that out. It's when it's something like I'm trying to help him, but because I'm helping him, I'm hurting her. It's those things, those more subtle things. Like, I'm a school counselor, I've been complaining about a teacher. Yes, the teacher didn't do the right thing, so I need to advocate for that student. And now I'm hurting the teacher because I'm going to the boss and saying, hey, this is what happened.
Yeah, I mean, very well put. I think that you could actually say, like, look, there are certain things that we know to be evil, right? Without saying that evil is a thing, we know certain things to be evil. They take away from the good. They diminish our flourishing. But even addressing those is difficult, right? Because we're caught in these complex, overlapping worlds, spheres, systems. So that to address child sex trafficking might mean that we get, you know, caught up in heinous diamond mining practices or something. You know what I mean? Like every which way we turn, there are competing claims on our lives that put us in these really precarious situations. It's easy to lose your sense of humor there. All right, in the back, and then we'll come here.
What about, like, foundational goods? Like, families.
Uh-huh.
And communities.
Uh-huh.
And focusing on the basic needs of them in order for them to flourish. I mean, that they have healthy relationships and you might get into like a socialist kind of, you know, Scandinavian model of, you know, self-governance. But maybe if you focus on those primary relationships, then the rest of society will hopefully be healthy as well.
Okay.
About abortion.
Okay. I mean, it's a very complex topic. One that I think I studiously avoided in this list of topics that are coming up. Yeah?
Don't you think that we're not supposed to solve those things? We're supposed to keep our eye on, if you're a Christian, what the Lord has asked. And that is to be in concert with him. So these things happen, and you know, we feel very bad about them. And prayer is a wonderful way to acknowledge this evil.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I'm concerned, my responsibility is to my relationship.
Okay. I want to pick up on several pieces of vocabulary that's been used in just these quick answers, okay? And the way that I want to do this is to highlight basic relationships, what you said. I'm going to skip over abortion, just on principle, as the principle is cheating. This question about prayer and responsibility, okay? Actually, let me write those down so I remember. This thing is terrible to do. Come back to them. Because I told you the first week, and then I told you last week that I would pay off on it, that I was going to talk about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? I told you that if you were in a class, you would hear that there are three different ways of making choices morally, right? Rules, goals, and virtues. This is what we opened the class up with again this morning. There's actually a fourth, sort of more contemporary model in Christian ethics called responsibility ethics, and that's why I wanted to pick up on this. And it comes from the early 20th century, several major figures throughout the 20th century were responsibility ethicists. One of them was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He wrote about responsibility, especially in his text, Ethics. So Bonhoeffer was a German pastor in the Confessing Church, which was, again, like aligned against the Nazis. Bonhoeffer was an aristocrat. He grew up in a very well-to-do family, was a genius. He finished his PhD when he was like 22, 23 years old, and then came to America and then became a pastor and then did his second dissertation, which you have to do in the European context. And all of this like in his, you know, early 20s. And then found himself in the world where Hitler took over and the Nazi regime comes to power and watches as all this happens. But because of his context as a very well-to-do and influential German, he was related by marriage and by blood to several people who were involved at a very high level in the conspiracies to overthrow Hitler. Later on in his life, as the regime continues, he actually... So he goes from running in what they called an underground seminary, which was just, it was not authorized by the Nazis, and the Nazis eventually shut it down. And he goes from operating one of these to participating in the coup attempt. The level of his involvement in the conspiracy is debated, but I mean, the reason that he remains so popular is because people are fixated and they really enjoy killing Hitler. This is one reason that Bonhoeffer retains so much, you know, popularity. Like, go this afternoon and click on like the History Channel and just see how many of them are about killing Hitler. All of them, right? It's fun. And so Bonhoeffer, like, he never actually was deeply involved in one of these, but it's the allure, right? It's actually kind of Manichaean, right? You've got a pure good and a pure evil. You've got this like good guy and this bad guy, and we can figure out, like, we know which side we're on in like Bonhoeffer versus Hitler. But the way that he thought about responsibility, I think, is important for the contemporary world in which we can see how it is that these different spheres or what have you overlap. There's a long tradition of Christian thinking about how it is that we think roughly what we now call church and state. It used to be called the two kingdoms doctrine or the two cities before that, different realms. But it was the idea that there are two sets of authority. There's God's authority and then there's the authority in the world. And the authority in the world is legitimate authority. God vested it in the world. We don't see any societies where there's no asymmetry of power. Right? Like, it's just sort of basic to human flourishing that there need to be leaders. Something like that. But how that got worked out was a deeply contested issue from the very early days of Christianity, Christian theology, all the way up to the contemporary world. And by the time that it got to Bonhoeffer's world in Nazi Germany, people have begun to think, some of them had begun to think, like Bonhoeffer, that some of that thinking had gone a little bit off the rails because it had cleared the space for totalitarianism. Like, you've got this one version of authority called God's authority, and you've got this other version of authority, and it does its own thing. It operates in its own sphere. And so whatever happens in this sphere is legitimate insofar as it's within this sphere and doesn't overtake or try and intervene into God's work. Bonhoeffer thought that this was messed up because it clears too much space for illegitimate uses of power. Everybody with me so far? Makes sense? What Bonhoeffer does is change some of the vocabulary and reworks it so that he says, look, there are, and he vacillates depending on what you're reading between the numbers, but roughly at least four different what he calls mandates. These are family, government, oddly what he calls the church rather than like the religious. I think he makes a conscious choice there that we won't have time to investigate, but it's interesting, right? And then a fourth sort of mandate or realm or order, whatever you want to call it, that was another vocabulary term that was in use, the orders of creation. So these were just ordered in creation. God had put them there. And so they have legitimacy no matter how they're used. And Bonhoeffer says, no, see, they're being used this way. So even if it was something that God had given, it couldn't be this version of it. It couldn't be Nazism. So the order of government, he translates it to become a mandate. And the reason he uses mandate, and this is a point I wanted to pick up on about the command of God, is because these things are commanded by God, but they have to follow God's command to be legitimate. And this includes the family. The church. The church is commanded by God, but it has to follow God's command to be legitimate, right? And then this fourth realm that he vacillates, the language is either culture or maybe economics or something. He's trying to catch like the world that we inhabit outside of or adjacent to family and church and government, right? Intermediate spheres of relationships. So what you do in your day-to-day life, like you go to museums, you go to whatever, this like world of culture and economics is its own other like mandate. In other words, you remember the talk about natural law? What we need by nature to flourish because of the kinds of creatures we are. Bonhoeffer's working up a kind of natural law here. You've got these four, and if I were to have a marker board here, what I would do is draw like circles, right? So you've got family and culture and church and government. And you are, this is the way I imagine it. You are an agent almost like a submarine. So imagine these are giant spheres, right? Buried under the ocean. And you're like a submarine navigating a really complex moral world. That's the water you're swimming in, right? These giant spheres, these mandates that shape our life, within which we live, we're almost like sending a ping out, right? You know what I'm talking about? In the submarine where they send it like the sonar, and it bounces off of these things to orient us in the world that we live in. So in the normal course of events, Bonhoeffer thinks that the world is actually fairly conducive to living a good life. Like, The family sphere is not going to be the same in ancient Athens as it was in the Weimar Republic Germany as it is now. We have different constitution, different ways of organizing family. But they're going to be recognizably something that we can call family, right? So in our world, like, if what makes you a good kid is to call your mom on Mother's Day, there's nothing written in the fabric of the cosmos that says Mother's Day is a thing, right? Hallmark made it up. But if in your context, one of the things that makes you a good, like, child, son or daughter, is to call your mom on Mother's Day, you do it. That's the right thing to do. It's not something that you have to do because it was written into the fabric of the world, but it's something that you do because it's contextually good. There are other things that are written into the fabric of the world, like honor your father and mother, right? That's something that we want to say is, like, pretty utterly basic to the idea of family. So as long as you are in the normal course of things, these different mandates are working the way that they're supposed to. The family is sort of operating as it's supposed to. The government is operating as it's supposed to. The church is operating. Like, you just go about living your life. You might not even know that you're making moral choices. So for Bonhoeffer, moral choice, the fact that we need to do ethics, the idea that we need to reflect on our behavior, is something that arises when something goes wrong. When something goes wrong in one of these mandates, one of them tries to take over the other one. So in his context, it's obvious which one is trying to take over the other one. It's the government. It's trying to take over everything. It's trying to take over family. You've got Hitler Youth. It's trying to take over the church. It actually creates the church, really, in a different constitution than it had before. And it's definitely trying to take over the culture. You couldn't even have an independent bowling league in Nazi Germany. It had to be Nazi bowling leagues. The whole society was ordered to the will of the government. So for Bonhoeffer, there's been a fundamental conflict in the way that the world is supposed to function, and it now requires us to weigh all of our choices against these competing goods. And we need to reset the world so that these fairly independent spheres, mandates, begin to function well again. Does that make sense? With me so far?
So what controls the balance?
Yeah. God? So the reason that he chooses the word mandate is because he wants to say that the fundamental question of ethics is, what is the will of God? So the question that we had on the table here, right? Which is a very difficult question to answer. Notoriously difficult question to answer. What is the will of God? Well, I mean, do we mean, what is the will of God? Like, should I buy this shirt or that shirt? Do we mean, what is the will of God? Like, should I buy this shirt or that shirt, knowing that this shirt was, you know, built in, like, slave labor conditions, and this one wasn't? But they're really complex questions that we learn to ask, and what is the will of God is a notoriously difficult question to answer. But the reason that he chooses the word mandate is because he sees that these were not written into creation, like orders of creation, right? The family doesn't have a once-for-all look. It's malleable to a certain extent, but it's still recognizable as a family. And that because they were commanded by God, and this is the key, they are answerable to God for their legitimacy. The big point here, though, and this is one last piece that I want to lay out before we move on to, like, cases for the, like, you know, more conversation for the rest of the class. For Bonhoeffer, and he reflects a large, large swath of the Christian tradition, one of the main concerns that we have to keep in mind as we do ethics is the fact that we are fallen. We don't will what God wills perfectly by nature. Bonhoeffer has a concept of original sin. If you prefer, like, a different sort of variation of this, the very famous quote by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, right, that the line between good and evil is not between this order and that, this person and that, this government and that. It runs right through the middle of every human heart. So Bonhoeffer, he buys into this basic Christian belief about human fallenness. We cannot, that which we will to do, we do not do, and that which we know not to do, that we do. It goes all the way back to St. Paul, right? We are complex creatures who live in a complex world. And so what is the will of God requires us to discern in a way that we're not even capable of. It requires God to make it clear to us in a certain way. The mandates don't exist at the moment of creation. God calls them into being, mandates them after the fall. So the order or the mandate of family gets arranged in a certain way after Adam and Eve have broken God's fundamental law, right? They've broken a command, and they actually are then constituted in a different way. They are clothed, right? And so societies begin to emerge. Governments, like ways of ordering our relationships, that's probably the most basic way of putting it, ways of ordering our relationships emerge or are commanded into being after the fall. They aren't necessary before it. Adam and Eve just live in direct communion with God and one another. The only law is don't eat that. Not don't do this, don't touch her, don't, you know, hit him, don't. No, it's just like, you just live. Everything is normal. Everything is great. And then there's a rift. There's a break, and it runs right through the center of every human heart. And to make up for that, to fix that, God puts into place certain ways of relating to one another, certain requirements of relationship. And these are family and government, and they're restraints, right, on our freedom just to do as we will. We've now abused our freedom. We've ripped it apart from the inside. And so God imposes certain norms around us that are like, you know, don't hit him. You know, don't do this. Like there are. And so Bonhoeffer sees these as required, like they are ways that God makes possible our flourishing in a world that we have torn apart. So they're very important for Bonhoeffer. The point in the middle of Nazi totalitarianism is not to do away with government. Bonhoeffer's clear on this. He says in one passage, we've now reached the point where the only thing that can save our society or civilization or the West or Europe, I can't remember which term he's using at this point, but the only thing that can save us because we've reached this point of utter decay is either the direct intervention of God. God reaches down into history and just writes it. Or, and here you would expect him, like if you were a good freedom fighter, to say, or like the organization of the masses, right? Resistance, like a coup d'etat of aristocrats, like something he actually knows about, right? He says, or the reemergence of a good state. Because what had been suspended was the normal flourishing of the state, right? It was just the will of Hitler. And so Bonhoeffer has on this one hand this dramatic idea that God might insert in history and just fix it, or what's really required is a better flourishing government to do away with this totalitarian one. Because government is commanded by God to make it possible for us to get along, because when left to our own devices, well, what's the first thing that happens when they emerge from the garden? Cain whacks his brother, right? Like, it's the first thing that happens. Augustine, by the way, says that this is where, like, he's the one who crafted the idea of the two cities. There's a city that loves God, and there's a city, this is what he calls the city of man, or the earthly city. And the earthly city, its founder was Cain. That's how Augustine says it. Like, this is where you get, like, the foundation of the city. Like, all human existence, like, all human relationships are founded in Cain's murder of Abel. So what we do in organizing our life in the middle of all of this is actually to reflect on what it is that God is trying to institute in the world. This is why basic relationships, I think, are really key to this. Like, call your mom on Mother's Day. And also, like, don't neglect these other big things that are weighing on us, right? And prayer is really important. I was at a conference at Oxford a few years ago where the convener of the conference didn't say anything. I think he gave a presentation at some point, but he sat quietly on the side for the rest of the time. And the question on the table was, does morality need God? And so, do you need God in order to have morality, or can you have morality independently? And so there was a question about the basic problem of evil that I started with, right? If there's a good God, sovereign God, why is there evil in the world? Why is there suffering? So one person, I think it was an atheist, was running this one session. And this is important because he was the one posing this question in a certain way. And he said, like, what do you do in the face of this grave suffering? Like, think Syria, right? And the convener of the conference got up and walked across and just went up to the microphone in the crowd where there was, you know, a point to raise questions or whatever. And he said, it makes me pray to the Lord. And then he went and sat down. And this was not a punt. Like, if you know this guy, he's willing to take any sort of, like, deep, terrible, hard philosophical claim and run with it. It's a real response about how it is that we act in the world so that we can conceive of our actions, these things that are very dangerous, right, unintended consequences and the whole bit, as prayers. We live in a world that's complex, and we are complex, and our ability to live in the world is limited. And we still have to act. And so to act is, in a way, a prayer to God, to take our action and do with it what God wants. All right, we have 2 minutes. And what I want to do, starting next week, we're going to begin to do, like, case studies. So the idea today was to determine what a moral topic is. And I've only gestured at that with Bonhoeffer's idea of the mandates. Moral topics I take to be those things that are not just a theological question for us. So, like, what is the nature of the incarnation? But how is it that we live in a world that's constituted like ours as beings who are constituted as we are? So finite, fallen, and fragile creatures who live in a finite, fallen, and fragile world, how do we live in that tension? So I'll give you one case as you walk out the door. You ready? I was recently having a conversation with a pastor of a fairly influential church in his mid-sized, like, small to mid-sized city. So a really influential church. And he had a parishioner who died. And this parishioner, on his social media and stuff, who's an old guy, I guess, and on his social media and stuff would post frequently about being a proud member of the KKK and, like, his own political views of the world. And, you know, the pastor said he was a son of a... He was a really bad person. He gets a call and is asked to do the funeral. So he thinks about it, prays about it for a couple of days, and he's about to call the widow and tell her, I can't do the sermon because of my own moral values and beliefs, right? That sort of stuff. And out in the outer part of his office, the administrative assistant was working on the recordings of his sermon from the week prior. And he overheard himself saying something about how God loves everyone. And God's love is infinite, so that even if at one point the prince of darkness himself renounced his evil ways and turned to Jesus Christ, God would open him with open arms. And he said, and so I had to pick up the phone and call the widow and say, I'll do it. So he goes and he finds one thing that he can say about this guy, which is that he used to play dominoes with him. That was the nicest thing he could find to say about the guy. And he does a funeral. And as he walks back to his office, like, after the funeral, the man's son is in the office. And he looks at him and says, how are you doing? He said, thank you for finding something nice to say about that son of a bitch. What should he have done? Should he have preached that funeral? Should he have found something nice to say about that KKK member? Should he have invited him to dinner before he died? Really lived into the message of Jesus to dine with sinners? Should you? When was the last time you had a white supremacist at your table? Okay. Should you? So there's a case. We're not going to talk about that one. I just thought I would throw it out there because it's. I usually try not to talk about pastors because most of the time I'm around pastors and they like to talk about being pastors. But in a room people who aren't pastors, what would you think? Would you want this pastor of this church to bury this man? Should he have used that funeral as a time to denounce him and to denounce his evil ways? How do you live in a world where those are the sorts of choices that you have to make? All right, thanks. Have a good night or good day.